basically got the computer model to output the status of a sarcomere. And then I wrote another computer program to turn that into what's called a scene description language. And then I used a thing called a ray tracer, which is a thing that turns a geometrical shape into a picture. Okay? So then I just did that for lots of little time steps in the computer model, and I produced this movie. It's basically the technology that makes like Disney films and stuff like that. Okay? So this is supposed to be looking down a myofibril. So this is an action filament. And here's a thick filament. And here's tropomyosin that moves around. And there's sort of pairs of myosin heads. This thing's roughly to scale. It's not perfect, but it's roughly to scale. So this is sort of something like 5 nanometers. The green blobs, the actin, are 5.5 nanometers in size. And let's see if I can get lucky. Let's watch this head here. Okay? So I'm going to try and just, it's a detached head, and then see how it suddenly popped on. That's it off. That's it on. And then it's going to do something else, he says optimistically. See how it changed color again? So the first thing you need to know, because I'm teaching in 412G, physiology 412G at the moment, and I showed this video last week, and all the students in that class seem to think that molecules have colors, and the molecules change colors. So the first thing you should know is that those colors are fake. Okay? But in this situation, or this movie, the colors are drawing things, molecules that are in different states. And what is supposed to have happened there is you've got a cross-bit that attached, and it did something to generate some sort of force, and then it did something else, and then it came off. So that is the cross-bridge cycle. And I thought what we would start by doing is we would start by going through the cross-bridge cycle. Okay. You okay with that? Do you have a question, or
I just mean super relaxed heads.
You don't see any super relaxed heads. That's a really smart thing. I made that movie before I knew about super relaxed heads. Yeah. Before anybody knew about super relaxed heads. So this was worked out. Well, I'm just trying to think historically. People knew that there was, that muscles contained actin and myosin probably in the 13th century. And the basic sort of steps in the cross-bridge cycle were worked out in the 70s. Lim and Taylor is the famous paper. And people are still arguing about specifics of it. Okay. So I tend to draw the cross-bridge cycle. Well, I tend to draw a cross-bridge as a spring. Okay. And I tend to draw a binding site as a little V like that. And that is a detached head because the myosin isn't locked into the binding site on it. Okay? And so this is detached. And then the first thing that happens is the crossbridge attaches. Okay? And think maybe the first thing you've got to do is you've got to get out of your head the idea that molecules are sort of fixed states. They're sort of buffeted around by thermal motion all the time, and the thermal motion's big. So if the myosin head is 5 nanometers, there's probably 5 nanometers of thermal motion moving that thing around. So this might be the average state, but it's going to be like fluctuating all the time with Brownian motion. So there is some rate constant for going forward, but there's also a rate constant for coming back. So pretty much all of the things I'm going to show you are reversible. You can go forward and you can go back. And some things are hard to reverse. If you go forward, you're less likely to come back. But in principle, you can still go both ways through each scoop. So the next thing that happens is you get a shape change in the myosin head. So this bit of the molecule, this is actually what's called the lever arm. It's a bit on the very head of the myosin molecule, the lever arm, and it undergoes a conformational change and tilts. And when it tilts, it now stretches the spring. So now you've got force. This is a force-generating state. So that transition from here to here is called the power stroke. And that's fundamentally what's driving force generation. This crossbridge that's going on here, for reasons we'll talk about later on, isn't actually generating force by itself. It's the shape change in the myosin head that generates force. Okay? So that's forward rate, that's backward rate. Now the next thing that happens is you get an even bigger that's like a power stroke times two. Okay, it might not be double, but there's an extra shift. So you get a little bit more force. And then what happens is the head detaches. So because there's no link between actin and myosin, no force at all from this one because the two things aren't connected. And then this thing pops back. So that is, as far as we know, the crossbridge cycle. Myosin heads come on, they do some sort of shape change, it's called the power stroke. They probably do some other sort of shape change. Head comes off, and you go back. So now I'll talk about the biochemistry. Okay? So, you would draw this state as actin plus M ADP PI. So the A is actin, the M is myosin, ADP and phosphate. And the A plus means that they're separate. I know that sounds weird, but the dot means you're joined together. And the plus means that you're separate. So this state is A plus M dot ADP dot PI. And this state is A dot M dot ADP PI. So now what's happened is that actin has joined this complex. You all with me at this point? Yeah. So the next thing that happens is phosphate release. So you give off a phosphate. So now you have K dot M dot ADP. And this one, you give off ADP. So now you have just actin and the bare myosin. And that's called the Rieger state, because you end up in the Rieger state if there's no ATP around. Because to come off from here to here, you need to bind ATP. So ATP comes on. So this becomes A plus M ATP, and then you hydrolyze the ATP to get ADP and phosphate. So I'll do two last things, just, and then we'll talk about it, and I'll take any questions. So if you give off phosphate to go through this power stroke, if you're going to reverse the phosphate, you must have phosphate coming back on. And similarly with ADP. So that's a lot of very complicated stuff in about 5 minutes. So maybe we should make sure we're all on the same page. Any questions about that? Have you ever seen anything like that before?
Yeah.
Okay. So is this pretty straightforward?
Yeah, I guess, is it, maybe just been on the computer a while, it's the, like when you're looking at different fiber types and speed of, like, contraction kinetics and unload shortening velocity, is it the myosin ATPase that's determining how rapidly that ATP gets phosphorylized, or can you talk about that a little bit, influencing speed of contraction between fiber types?
Yeah, I mean, I can try. Okay. So, in general, the people that care about the intricacies of the crossbridge cycle are not people who care about things as trivial as fiber types. Okay? So I could go to a biophysical society meeting, which is probably the international meeting that focuses on this more than anything else. You will never hear anybody talk about things like fiber types or fast to slow transitions or stuff like that. They literally don't care. Okay? The people that care about the molecular level detail are people who care about fundamental mechanisms. And what they will do is they will try and pick, you know, for example, to get myosin, okay? The easiest way to get myosin is to start with a big chunk of muscle and basically degrade it with a whole variety of biochemical techniques. They will try to start with a big muscle that is predominantly one fiber type. So the classic preparation for years and years and years was the psoas muscle from a rabbit, because it was mostly fast muscle. And it was relatively easy to get, and you got quite a big chunk of tissue. It is clearly the case that as you get fiber type transitions, you get a whole load of isoform changes in the muscle. So I am not an expert in this, but you obviously, you do get changes in myosin, but you also get changes in the troponin subunits. And you get, I think you can get changes in alpha and beta tropomyosin, and things that probably you don't think very much about because you're probably a fast slow person, so you think mainly about myosin. but the other accessory proteins of the sarcomeres change too. And so, in general, the people that care about the details here care more about things like, does phosphate come off and then it does a power stroke? Or does it do a power stroke and then phosphate comes off? Right? Mm-hmm. So, I would say that probably different fiber types, different phosphorylation states of the regulatory proteins, all of these things will change different rate constants in different ways. And you know, maybe what happens if you change the phosphorylation state of troponin is you change this backward rate constant. Whereas if you go from fast to slow, you change this rate constant. Whereas if you change, I don't know, myosin binding protein C, you change this rate constant.
Yeah.
And so there's clearly an awful lot of what some people would call stamp collecting, right? You can just go through and like get more and more detail, but you don't really change the fundamental processes. And in general, the people that care about the intricacies of the cycle don't care about the fact that muscles get fast or slower, they get bigger or smaller. Do you agree with that, Dr. Butterfield?
I do. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, in 1971, Lynn and Taylor came up with a model, and I think they made a rate limiting step for the most part in their model.
I think most people would say that the rate limiting step is ADP release. Okay? But that depends a lot on whether you're talking about an isometric muscle, a shortening muscle, an eccentric muscle. It depends a lot on the level of activation. So, for example, I think predominantly what's determining the rate of force development is actually the rate at which binding sites become available. It's not a problem with the cross-bridge cycle. It's actually to do with the interactions between the thick and thin filament, right? And so, personally, I take any claim that X is the rate-limiting step with a grain of salt, right? And that is because it might be the rate-limiting step under some conditions, but it's not going to be the rate-limiting step under other conditions. Sorry, there was another question there, Andrew.
Oh, what are the electrical designs that are related to
What are the enzymes that are driving these things? I would say it was the myosin head itself. So the myosin head is a motor enzyme. Yeah. Okay. People don't talk about an enzyme that catalyzes these reactions.
Because there's ATP is
that. This whole cycle is an ATPase because it's being powered from the energy from ATP coming in here. So, you know, I've been hearing people talk about this for literally 20 years. And that's because that's how long I've been in the field. I would have said that until about a year, maybe 3 years ago, this was incredibly esoteric, by which I mean a few people cared a lot about it, but most people didn't care. But I would have said, actually, that this has suddenly become clinically interesting. And it's become clinically interesting because a few companies, primarily on the West Coast, basically developed high-throughput assays. And I think most of them were based on... it's going to sound funny, but I think they were based mostly on slime mold. So the green... I actually don't know what slime mold is, but I presume it's a green sort of slimy lichen-like thing. And it turns out that that has a different type of myosin in it. There's 26 families of myosin And when you're thinking of fast to slow transitions in muscle fibers, you're talking about sub-elements of myosin family 2, right? So, you know, you've got fast myosin, slow myosin, whatever other types of myosin, they're on this sort of diagram that looks like this, but that diagram is equally as big over here. I mean, there's maybe, I'm guessing, 1,000 types of myosin, of which maybe 4 are found in skeletal muscles. Okay, and one that's way over here is myosin 1, and it's found in a thing called dictyostelium, and dictyostelium is a slime mold. And I think what they did is they basically set up 96 well plates, these little sort of plastic plates with little wells in them. And if I think the myosin makes the slime mold, the cells move around. It's to do with cell motility. And so if the myosin works really quickly, then you will see the cell spreading very quickly. And if you stop the myosin, the cells will stop. Right? So essentially what you can do is you can sort of take your 96 well plate, so a little sort of plate with 96 holes on it, put a dictyostelium cell in each little hole, and then put a drug on. And if the drug makes the cell go quickly, and you can do this with a microscope, you can just with the microscope basically scanning along and just watching the cells grow, you can get you can try and see what is changing the myosin speed. So they screened, 100,000 molecules. And they found, 1,000 that looked like they did something. So they took those 1,000 and then ran some more sophisticated tests. And then they got 100 that still seemed like they worked. And then they took those 100 and ran more sophisticated tests, which ultimately ended up with, you know, people tying in fibers and putting in drugs. But you can't test 100,000 molecules with high-level muscle mechanics. So these were high-throughput screens for myosin modulators. And there are 2 of them that are now in tests for patients who have heart failure. So if you have heart failure, you have a heart that doesn't work like it should. Sometimes it doesn't squeeze properly, sometimes it doesn't fill properly. So there's a drug called omecamtiv. And it's in trials, and the trials are pretty advanced. I mean, we're now at the stage where it's trials with thousands of patients, and it's in trials for patients who don't squeeze very well. And what it does, well, it's interesting. I happen to have published a paper on this recently, so I have a friend called Chris who's at Penn State, and Chris has literally spent 20 years trying to, you know when I said it matters whether the phosphate comes off and the head moves, or whether the head moves and the phosphate comes off? Chris has literally spent 20 years trying to work that out. He is a world leader in this transition. Okay? So the original paper, which came out in Science, describing this drug, saying, you know, maybe this could be used, said it's phosphate. It said omecamtiv mecarbil accelerates phosphate release. And Chris, so my lab collects hearts from the operating room from patients getting transplants. So we've got lots of human myocardium. So we gave little tubes of human myocardium from UK patients to Chris. Chris took those little sugar cubes of muscle and turned them into myosin molecules. And he measured the rate constants of every step in this cross-bridge cycle. And then he put the drug OM on and he saw what had changed. And then what we did is we took muscle cells from the same strips and we measured the mechanics. So the original paper says drug increases phosphate release. So if you make this faster, you should get myosin heads going from here into here more quickly. So, you know, I mean, oh, here's another thing. Cross bridges are going in a cycle, right? So there's heads in every state at every instant time. So maybe there's 20% there, 20 there, 20 there, 20 there, 20 there, and luckily that adds up to 100. Okay? Now, if you accelerate this step, what you're really doing is you're making this 25 and this 15. But you screw the whole thing up, right? These are no longer 20, right? The whole thing adjusts a bit. But if you accelerate this relay rate, you will bias heads into this state. And these states produce force, and these ones don't. So you should get a better squeeze out of the myocardium. Yes.
Is this drug only specific to the cardiac muscle?
It is thought to be specific to cardiac muscle. Turns out, it doesn't do that. Okay? It turns out, we think what it does is it massively accelerates this step. So we think it massively accelerates this step. And so what you do is you basically empty this state. So cross bridges, as soon as they get into here, they basically jump straight on. And because there are so many heads in this state, more of them leak into this state. Right? But when you actually measure the transitions, it looks to us that really what you've done is you've pushed this up. Now, it's not catastrophic because they've given it to patients in low doses and the patients haven't died, right? But there's sort of phase one, phase two, phase. Do you know anything about clinical trials? Yeah. So phase one is like basically, does it kill you? Does it kill healthy people? And if we give it to you, how long is it going to take to get out of their system? Phase two is basically, it looks like it's not going to kill healthy people. Let's see what it does in people who are sick. But there, you have small numbers of people in those trials. You're really just testing efficacy and, sorry, you're testing safety and dosing. And then phase three is, let's test it in thousands of people and see if it actually makes a clinical difference. So we are in late stage phase two, maybe the beginning of phase three. If it had been a blockbuster drug, you would probably have seen clinically meaningful improvements in phase two. What I think we're in is, it sort of maybe helps a bit, but to know if it really helps, we're going to have to look at phase three. So that probably means it doesn't help an awful lot. It's not magic, okay? It's not going to cure heart failure, but it might help, right? What is actually happening is the drug is prolonging. So cardiac muscle is different, right? Cardiac muscle squeezes, relaxes. When you give patients this drug, the squeeze goes on for longer, right? And that's actually kind of bad because now you have less time to fill. And the other problem is that when your heart squeezes, the intramuscle pressure in the myocardium goes up, so you don't get coronary blood flow. So when you prolong the squeeze time, you actually reduce coronary perfusion. And some of the patients seem to be getting a bit of myocardial ischemia. So you get a better squeeze, but the myocardium is losing blood supply. And if you think about it, if you massively increase this rate constant, Now you have lots of heads that are attaching, but not very many of them are leaking through to a force generating state. So this is like trying to pull your myofilaments through quicksand. There's a huge drag on the myofilaments from all these cross bridges that have attached but haven't generated force. So in our hands, what it does is it does a lot, it changes calcium sensitivity a lot, it makes the muscle much more sensitive to calcium. You get more force at low levels of calcium, you don't get more force at high levels of calcium, and you can basically stop the myofilaments from sliding past each other. So it's complicated. Okay? The other drug that's made it into trials, there are patients who inherit mutations that cause cardiomyopathies. So cardiomyopathies are where your heart grows badly. And there are mutations, again, it's subtle, but and there are exceptions, but in general, gain-of-function mutations, ones that make your heart get pump powerfully, cause hypertrophy. They cause the muscle to get really big. And your heart can get so big it stops working properly. And there is a drug called MYK-461. And MYK-461, I mean, I don't know if you trust this, but the paper, and the paper for omecamtiv mecarbil is wrong. The first paper for MYK-461 says that you are reducing, you're accelerating, you are accelerating that reverse rate. So actually what this drug is doing, it's thought to bind directly to the myosin head somewhere. They know where the OM binds on the myosin head. This one is thought to empty or pull the state backwards here. So you end up with a less contractile heart. But having a hypercontractile heart gets patients into trouble. And if you give this drug to mice that are carrying the mutation that causes big hearts, you can turn the heart back to a normal size. And they are now in trials with patients who've got this mutation. So it sounds weird. I mean, you're actually trying to make the heart contract less well. But in a subclass of patients who have inherited cardiomyopathies, having a heart that contracts too well actually causes myocardial hypertrophy, which ultimately stops the heart working because the heart just gets too big and bulky to do anything. So I guess the take-home point is people have been doing this for 50 or 60 years. For 50 or 60 years, it seemed very esoteric and, you know, not super translatable. And in the last couple of years, it's become incredibly translatable. Right? And so knowing intimate knowledge of this biophysics could perhaps lead to therapies for people who have muscles that don't work like they should. Okay? We've got about 35 minutes to go. Okay? Was that helpful?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Who's your favorite muscle scientist? Other than Dr. Cooper. who have you heard of?
Heard of Andy?
You've heard of some people.
The classics, Phoebe Hill and Huxley. What? We're just talking about who we've heard of.
Okay. So you've heard of A.B. Hill. You've heard of
A.F. Huxley.
A.F. Huxley. So I know Huxley.
Dave Morgan.
Dave Morgan? Oh, yeah. Was it Dr. Butterfield that told you about Dave Morgan?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Strong feelings about Dave Morgan.
I didn't meet A.B. Hill. So in Britain, I did my PhD in Britain. You don't have an advisory committee, in America you have a committee. And in Britain you don't have a committee. What you do is you write your thesis, and your head of department says, oh, we need an external examiner. So it's somebody comes along that's not associated with your university. And they haven't really had any contact with you. And they come along, they read the thesis, and then they come and they give you an oral exam, which is called a viva, viva voce in Latin. So for reasons that are lost in the history of time, that person's called the oral, the external exam. My external examiner was Andrew Huxley.
Oh my God.
Okay? And... Did you know that?
Yeah, I know that. I was slowly telling multiple people about that.
Okay. Well, I'll just tell them about it. So what happened is I wrote a thesis on the short-range elastic component of muscle, short-range properties of relaxed fibers. You heard some about that yesterday, Monday. Pretty good. Paper. We'd written a paper. Been accepted into J Physiol. Andrew Huxley comes along. My exam was supposed to start at 9. And I actually started about 12:30. And it went on for 4.5 hours. So it was me and Sir Andrew Huxley, who was, I mean, literally maybe one of the most famous scientists in Britain. He was president of the Royal Society. So it was me, Sir Andrew Huxley, and a guy called Dave Jones, who was the head of department. And after about 2.5 hours, an administrator came in with a cup of tea, or like a tray of tea, because it's Britain. And they sit it down on the table, and there's three of us sitting around the table with my thesis. And Andrew Huxley turns to Dr. Jones, and Dave Jones, and he goes, "Do you think the candidate takes milk in his tea?" And Dave looked at me and he goes, "Ken, do you take milk in your tea?" And I went, "Dr. Jones, yes, I do take milk in my tea." And Dr. Jones goes, "Yes, Sir Andrew, he takes milk in his tea." And so it was a series sitting around the table like this. It was pretty horrendous. So at the end of 4.5 hours, it finished. And I went back to the lab. And my supervisor, Martin, I mean, he was basically crying in a corner. Because it turned out that Andrew Huxley had come and he had said, this is the worst thesis I have ever seen in my life. There's no way this should ever be a thesis. And you need to fail. And at that point, literally, you're just done. And Dave Jones, I'm not a religious man, but I do need to give a special prayer of thanks to Dave Jones. Dave Jones said, "Well, it wasn't quite that bad." The next day we got a letter from the Journal of Physiology saying, "You should retract this paper. We understand there's some question about it." And the university, Dave Jones said, "Well, you have to give Ken a chance to rewrite the thesis." So I rewrote the thesis. It took me about 9 months. And I sent it back in, and Andrew Huxley looked at it. He says, "Actually, this is quite good then. And I need a couple of weeks to write my final report." And then the final report came in, and it said, "This second version of the thesis is really quite good. And I will now write back to J Physiol and say you can have that paper published. But on reflection, the first version was so bad, I shouldn't have given you the chance to rewrite, so you fail." So this was all quite traumatic. It cost me a lot of money, it was fairly stressful. I mean, to be honest, I was really quite close to giving up science, but it was personal, right? It was like, I mean, I was not very happy about this, but it was personal. And eventually, he I mean, he started to write things that were more and more extreme. Like, well, we're in this position, right, where there's a, like, the most famous living muscle scientist and my head of department. And one of them says he should pass, or he should fail. The other one says he should pass. And you're trying to find a third examiner to have a consensus view, but we are trying to very carefully select a third examiner because we're trying to make sure it's going to go our way, not, or the university was trying to make sure it went my way. That's right. Honestly, it was kind of hard to find somebody. Everybody read the thesis, everybody said the thesis is really good. Was, of course I'll help. Oh, it's Dr. Hart. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm really busy. And so that happened a lot, which was quite sad. It's not what you hope, right? So eventually, he said, in retrospect, the first version wasn't quite so bad as I thought. In fact, it really took me about 3 months of concerted effort to find the fundamental flaw. And there's nobody else in the world that could have found that flaw. But that means there can't be a qualified third examiner, right? Basically, I am the only person in the world that is qualified to review this thesis. At which point the university said, well, I mean, it's not a great thesis, but if there's only one person in the world that can find the flaw, it's probably good enough to get a PhD, right? And eventually he retracted. And then he offered me a job as a tech.
Oh my God.
And about 3 years later, I met him at a conference, and it was a small conference, so about 100 people at the conference, and we were there for a week, so you couldn't help but bump into him. And we were going, I was going up the stairs, and he was coming down the stairs. We did that, you know, shimmy thing, you know, like this, right? And he looked at me and he goes, tell me, young man, are you attending this conference? Or are you a member of the college cleaning staff? And I said, well, I'm actually attending the conference, Sir Andrew. And he goes, oh, in that case, perhaps you can tell me where the office is. And I said, yes, it's just down this corridor here. Let me show you. I don't honestly know whether he knew who I was. I mean, I really don't know whether he knew who I was. I mean, and it was an awful, I mean, honestly, it was an awful, awful experience. And I mean, I'm now the director of graduate studies from the physiology program, and no student should have to go through what I went through. But it was, I mean, now that I almost quit. I almost left science. I was so pissed off. My dad, who was a university administrator, he was one of these people that he had worked for the university for 40 years, different university, but he was a university guy. He believed in academia. He thought academics did good stuff. He was one of these guys that was going to work until he dropped. He quit his job because he was upset that no, he was biased, my dad was biased, right? But my dad was upset that they couldn't find a third party examiner to stand up and do the right thing, right? So that was bad, right? It was one of the most formative experiences of my life. I went head to head with the Nobel Prize winner for 6 months here, right? Eventually, he sort of half agreed that he could be maybe slightly misinterpreting something. I went to Wisconsin to do. I went to Wisconsin. You know that paper? That paper was basically doing the experiments that were going to prove or disprove what he thought. And they were what I predicted in my thesis, right? So he was wrong, right? And I think, I mean, by the time he examined my thesis, he was probably 85. He's probably, with the exception of Dr. Cooper and Dr. Butterfield, the smartest person I will ever meet. He was not the nicest man that I've ever met. But I now think of it like this. I mean, he was so smart in muscle. And he didn't even win the Nobel Prize for muscle. He won the Nobel Prize before he started working on muscle. He won the Nobel Prize for working out how action potentials worked with Eccles and Al Hodgkin. Imagine, okay, sometimes I'm teaching undergrads who don't care. And they are not very quick on the uptake. And I am trying to explain, I don't know, muscle is made of myosin. And it takes 45 minutes to get across that maybe muscles have myosin and actin. And I try 17 ways to explain it, you know. And it's frustrating. Imagine you never have a conversation with somebody that you find intellectually interesting. You must spend your whole life walking around going, my God, everybody is so stupid. Right? Okay? Now, I never do that, right? Because, well, maybe very occasional student, right? But 99.9% of people that I meet are smarter than me. So it's really interesting, right? But imagine you never meet somebody that you can actually learn something from. It must be a frustrating experience because you must see things differently than everybody else. Right? So I have to tell you, it took me a long time to get to this stage about my relationship with Sir Andrew. It's kind of like breaking up with a significant other. You go through many stages of grief and anger and frustration, and eventually you become indifferent. And I mean, he caused me a lot of angst and a lot of anxiety. And, you know, my dad retired and my PhD advisor quit very shortly afterwards. I mean, it was pretty traumatic. He's probably the smartest man I'll ever meet. And I can see why he did what he did. But I think he made two fundamental mistakes, right? He predicted the results of an experiment. And he didn't like my thesis, because my thesis actually did the experiment, and my results weren't what he thought they should be. And so he just never believed it, right? He thought he had this knowledge of what the experiment would do, but he'd never actually done the experiment. And so he never believed me. Right? The other thing he did, which I'm going to try not to do, is he was 85, and he was still in a position where he could influence the progression of young scientists. And to be honest, I think he was poorly calibrated, right? Was my PhD the best PhD ever? No. Was it good enough to get a PhD? Yes. Should he have gone to geophysiology and got us to retract the paper? No. Right? It had gone through scientific peer review. It had gone through all of those processes, and he just said, I don't trust it. Right? But because he had that power, he influenced it. So he stayed in the field in a position where he influenced the careers of young people who were coming up, when probably he had lost calibration. Right? He is probably the smartest person I will ever meet, and he deserves a lot of respect. He's not a very nice person, or he wasn't a very nice person. But you don't have to be a nice person to make a big impact. So, yeah, I didn't think I was going to talk about this. There you go. Was that important?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Were there any lessons that your advisor learned that he shared with you going through that experience?
Yeah. Well, okay. So I'll tell you why Martin did it. So my PhD buddy Martin, like, pretty
esoterically famous in a small sense of the word. Pretty good. Sort of muscle tone.
Martin was never that interested in muscles. Martin was interested in how the body controlled motion. So he was interested in how you stand. Right? I understand it's quite hard to stand. Right? And along the way, he had sort of realized that maybe the muscles were relevant to how you stand. He was mainly a neural person, but he was interested in how the muscles were. And so he basically came along, he had no muscle pedigree, he came along and he started doing experiments on muscles to sort of see how the mechanical properties of muscles were relevant to posture. And then he did some experiments on whole muscles, and then he went into single fibers, and I was the PhD student who happened to do the single fiber experiments. So I basically did in single fibers what he had done, maybe a little bit less sophisticated wise in whole muscles. Martin, so in Britain, because there's no advisory committee, that's just pass-fail, there is this theory, I don't know if it's still there, but there was a theory that you could judge the sort of quality of the PhD student by the quality of the external examiner. And we had happened to give a talk at, it was a talk and a poster at a regional meeting, and Huxley had been there. And he had come up and asked us some questions, and he'd been very supportive, right? And we'd asked him a couple of things, and he'd written a letter back and things. And he seemed very supportive and interested. And so Martin, because he was trying to help me, wrote to Sir Andrew Huxley and said, I think Ken's thesis is pretty good. I'm looking for an examiner that will help Ken advance in his career. Could you suggest somebody that might be good in the field? Because we were sort of crossing into a new area that Martin didn't know very well. And Andrew Huxley wrote back and said, I would do it. And I remember Martin coming into the lab one day and he says, Ken, Martin, he was pretty famous. It helped me get my first job, as my examiner. I was pretty surprised he said he would do it, but what could possibly go wrong? on the basis that Huxley basically knew what I was doing, right? And he'd basically seen most of the key results, and he'd been supportive. So if he's going to, why would you offer to be the external examiner if you knew you were going to create a storm? And what could possibly go wrong? A lot went wrong. So you asked what Martin learned?
Yeah.
Okay, Martin learned that you never, ever, ever, ever ask somebody who's not your buddy to be the external examiner. Right? And, it was done with the best of intentions. Honestly, my parents have never forgiven Martin. It's kind of sad, right? I was young, right? I didn't have a significant girlfriend, although don't tell her that. at the time, I didn't have a significant girlfriend. So, my parents were looking at their kid and, watching them go off and try and do stuff. And, my dad knew about universities and things. They think he was at fault. I'm going back to Britain to see, to give a talk next month, and I'm going to go and see my mom and dad, and I'm going to spend 2 days with Martin. We're good friends. Can I tell you one more thing?
Yes. Go for it.
So about 3 months into the 6 months rewriting of the thesis, Huxley wrote a letter to Martin and said, I think Ken's been making up his data. Martin comes to me and he goes, here's iteration 324 of the story. This is the next thing that's happening. I don't make up my data. He goes, I know. And like most of my mentoring with Mark, I learned everything I love about science from Mark. Right? I didn't learn maths, I didn't learn cross pitching heads, but I learned everything I love about science from Mark. And most of my mentoring took place in the pub. Right? We would do, I mean, he would actually do some experiments, but he was pretty busy. But once or twice a week, he'd come into the lab at 5 or 6, and he'd say, let's go for a pint. And we'd walk over to the staff house, and we'd have a couple of pints. And sometimes we'd talk about papers or stuff, but actually we talked about science. We talked about the experiments, we talked about stuff. So I got a tremendous amount of learning sitting in the pub drinking beer with my mentor. So he sat down and he said, well, we need to talk about this data fabrication. And I went, do you think I made it up? He goes, no. I said, but Mark, you know, I wrote the software to do the experiments. I wrote the software to analyze it. I wrote the software to do the computer modeling. I mean, I wrote all the software for everything, right? I did most of the experiments in the evenings because they took days to work, right? And, you know, you'd gone home before I'd even got the experiments working most of the night. Most of the data I collected at 2 o'clock in the morning. How do you know I didn't cheat? I mean, it would have been easier for me to write the software to fake the data than it would have been to write the software to do the experiments. He goes, I know. But you didn't cheat. And I go, but how do you know? And about 3 pints into this conversation, he goes, Ken, I know that you didn't cheat. Because if you cheated, if you'd made your own data, you'd have had good data.
Okay.
And, yeah. So I didn't make the data up. I mean, I think that was it. I think Huxley just couldn't believe that the experiment didn't work out like he thought it should. So he thought I made it up, right? And 14 minutes to talk about Huxley's 1957 paper, maybe the best paper at Muscle. Yeah, it's still a system in Britain. Yeah. It's good when it works well. It doesn't have the same safeguards that an advisory committee has. It's similar-ish in Canada. Yeah.
But so it's in Australia, too.
Same as Switzerland, Germany.
So we're the real
ones. We need our hands on it.
Okay, I'm going to try and do this relatively quickly. If you look at this picture, you will see that there are many, many, many mice heads. There are many, many, many places that they can attach to. And it turns out that there is non-integer spacing between them. What the heck does that mean? It means that if you think about the mice heads being a cone, and you think about the actin sites being a cone, they are misregistered. So there's no place where, if you're in register of one place, you are out of register somewhere else. So it turns out that's probably a critical design feature of muscle, right? You can never get the positions in a place where a myosin can't reach an actin. Because if you make it such that a myosin can reach an actin in one place, somewhere else along the filaments will be in register. Okay? So really what that means is that there is... And this was basically the basis for Huxley's 1957 paper, the first molecular-level mathematical model of muscle. He basically said, here is a myosin head, and there are going to be binding sites at all different sort of spaces of it. There'll be some myosin heads with the closest binding sites to the left. There'll be some myosin heads with the closest binding sites to the right. So instead of thinking about 300 myosin heads, let's think about one myosin head, and let's say, you know, what's the probability of it attaching over here? What's the probability of it attaching there? What's the probability of attaching over there? That gets you into what are called Charles Bridge. Population. Distributions. Okay. So basically, the Huxley 57 model is about cross-bridge population distributions. And what he does is he says, here is a binding site. This is a spring with constant k. And the distance between the binding site and the Meissen head is x. So you know Hooke's law, so you know f equals kx. Okay. So now, all you have to do to calculate what the muscle's doing is you say how many cross bridges are bound with each possible value of x. And you get total force is the sum of kx. And if you're into fancy maths, it's the integral of k, or k times the integral of n, which is a function of x, x dx, where n of x is the number of heads bound at x. Okay, that's a little bit of calculus that maybe you do and maybe you don't. But basically, we're taking cross bridges as a function. Each one is a linear spring. There'll be a certain number of cross bridges bound with each value of x, and you're going to sum those forces. Okay? So, that approach is very general. You can do that for the five-state kinetic scheme that I talked about. You can do it for anything. Huxley chose a very simple two-state system. Cross bridges that were detached, cross bridges that were attached. And he set up what is called F and G. F was the rate constant for going on, G was the rate constant for going off. If you think about it, those rate constants, they're not single values, they have shapes. Because a cross bridge is very unlikely to attach to a binding site that is a long, long way away, because it won't be able to reach. But it's probably fairly likely to be able to attach to a binding site that's close. Similarly, if you take a Meissen head and you stretch it a long way, it's going to come off. Whereas a Meissen head that stays at a short length, that's probably going to stay on for longer. So what Huxley did was he set up, let's go back here. He set up, here's x, and so you've got detached, attached, you've got f going on, g coming off. So what Huxley said was, this is x, this is 0. These are rate constants. So he said f looks like this. So he said, I don't think anybody really thinks that this is what a cross-bridge attachment rate constant looks like. But it mathematically works really well, and you can solve it analytically, so you could get, like, written down algebraic expressions for the answers if he did this. He tried several things. He said cross bridges never attach when they're pulled backwards. And they can attach until they're stretched up to some distance h, which is probably about the power stroke distance, about 5 nanometers. But this is long before anybody knew about power strokes. And the further you go up to this point, the faster they attach. And then he said cross bridges detach with a rate constant g, and g increases linearly with x as you stretch the cross bridge, but if you pull backward on the cross bridge comes off really fast. And if you calculate the maths, what you end up with is you end up with X for an isometric muscle looks like that. You've got a whole bunch of cross bridges attached with a positive X. So that gives you a lot of force because you've got lots of cross bridges. The sum of N of X, KX, with all the X's being positive, that gives you a lot of force. Now, if you think about it, if you take the muscle and you shorten it a little bit, what happens is that all the cross bridges that were attached at X are now attached at X minus a little bit because you pulled them all backwards. Right? So this new distribution, when the muscle shortens, now looks like that. And it's less force because some of these cross bridges are counteracting the positive ones. There are some cross bridges that are minus kx, and they are producing a force that balances the ones in the positive direction. Okay? Now, if you leave it at that state, these cross bridges will come back off, and you'll get new ones reattaching over here, and the population will reassert itself. But if you keep shortening, this will now get pushed over like that, and pushed over like that, and pushed over like that. And now what you end up with is you end up with the number of cross bridges at each value of x, and you can always integrate this population and get the force. Right? And so, 3 minutes, and then we're done. If you go to mysim.org, which is software that I wrote, and if you go to here, you'll basically see. I just done that. It's moving around. Okay, so if I. Apparently, if I move. Okay, that's weird. Okay.
That's that square I was talking about. That's what it looks like when you distort the long way.
And this is what happens when you do unloaded shortening. What happens is you get.
This is the muscle. You see how it gets pulled over to the left and the shape changes?
That's basically what's happening is the muscle is shortening at its max speed. And the max speed occurs when the cross bridge populations are forced by the positive cross bridges is exactly balanced by the force by the negative constraint cross bridges. That's why it's zero force. You've got as many cross bridges generating force on the plus side as generating force on the negative side. So that's basically Huxley's 1957 model in 7 minutes, and it was hard to do it much better than that because we wasted half an hour talking about it.
That's great.
Any questions about that? That the paper where he describes it is about 150 pages long, of which about 30 of it is mathematics. Right? It's a tough read. But to be honest, I personally think that if you love muscle, you should read that paper. It's an amazing paper. It's a tough read, but if you love muscle, you should read it. Dr. Cooper, Dr. Funderfield, anything?
Super.
I'll agree with you. I do much of paper every year I find something in the community that is report. It's so chock full of
stuff. It's so chock full of stuff. It's just as much. Thanks, everybody. Thank you. Thank you.